folks, and welcome to Dungeon Casters, the Dungeon Master Advice Show for rookie DMs by rookie DMs. I'm Scott, and Ben couldn't make it this week, so it's just me. Yep, only me. Sorry this episode's up a little bit late, some things come up, you guys know how it is. And also, this week I'm going to do something a little different, because it's just me. Instead of having a topic that Ben and I, you know, kind of shoot back and forth and talk about, this week I am going to directly answer the questions you folks have sent me and Ben at Gmail and on Twitter. So, starting us off today, we have a question from Bennett. And Bennett's, you know, question watered down is, what do you think the player's responsibility in fitting into the campaign world is, and what role does a GM play in the process? So, his question was a little bit larger than that on the email he sent us, but the idea kind of waters down to player flexibility, because GM flexibility is something we talk about a lot. We talk about how, you know, as a dungeon master, as a game master, it's your job to kind of alter what you're saying and alter what you're doing and make the story tailored to your players. Something that doesn't get talked about a lot and something that we haven't really touched on too much is that it is a two-way street with that. So, as we've said many times before, the way we think of Dungeons & Dragons and the way we kind of conceptualize it is that it is a joint storytelling experience with you and your friends. So you guys are all telling this, like, rad fantasy story, and, you know, you're each controlling different parts. The players control the protagonist, the GM, the DM controls, you know, the plot and the setting and the, you know, less important characters and the antagonists and so on and so forth. But, like, a lot of times that does leave most of the wiggle room on the GM's side of things. Now, if you're running a, you know, specific homebrew campaign, something that's completely something that's completely, you know, out of your own head, we've talked about how it's great to use the character backstories to talk to your players before you start you know, the campaign, and see what they want their characters' backstories to be, and then use those and build those into your story. That being said, as a GM, you have, you know, this story idea already. You have the plot, you have it ready to go, and you're taking your characters and kind of putting them in. Or if you're running a pre-made where the plot is already kind of laid out for you, it is important on the player's side of things to be just as flexible as the DM. Because at the end of the day, you're all agreeing to sit down together and tell a story. And with that, if a player has, you know, this backstory and they worked really hard on it, and it kind of sucks not being used, but sometimes you just gotta fucking deal with it. And you can use that player backstory to inform your actions as a player, as a character, instead of, oh, this, you know, this group of bandits murdered my family, so now I'm on a quest to get revenge, and nothing else is going to matter to me, so I'm going to ignore every plot hook unless it directly correlates to these bandits I'm hunting down. Like, that sucks, because not only are you taking anything the GM says to you and kind of just saying, like, screw you, dude, I don't care, but also, like, all the other players now have to be hooked in and dragged along on your story. So, because it is a group activity, because there's more than one person involved here, you do have to acknowledge that, you know, this might not be the thing we're addressing right now. There might be another storyline, plot hook, or event that's more important to us as a group or as a, you know, campaign in general right now. So with that, as a player, you have to be flexible enough to put aside your own wants and desires to, you know, go for the greater good. And that's kind of the idea of being a hero, is that, like, yes, you have this revenge tale that's really cool and that you want to do, but also, like, there are people who need you more right now. And so you have to, you know, put that aside and help them. So an important thing is, for a character, the answer to the question, do you want to be here? And here meaning the story that the GM is telling. So if your character doesn't, if your character does not care about the GM's story and just wants to do their own personal backstory, then that's something you have to address. And that's something that, like, your character doesn't have to, you know, die, or you don't have to change your character. If that character would be unwielding about wanting to do their specific backstory and not go on this quest for the greater good, then it's time to roll a new character and say, like, oh, my first guy didn't agree with this, so he left. Now I have a new person that would be more amenable to the idea of going on this quest. And you can always bring characters back and switch them out. That's the thing, is, like, there's no limit to the amount of characters you can switch through. I mean, it's better for continuity's sake to stay to a single character for a campaign, but, I mean, you look at a lot of, you know, podcasts and things like that that, you know, a lot of people listen to, and you see certain players get tired of their characters and talk to the GM and have them killed off, or certain players, you know, go through periods where they play another character every couple weeks and have die at the end just so they can find a character that fits well for, you know, their current playstyle. So it's the kind of thing where you have no limit on the amount of Dungeons & Dragons you can play. So if you make a character and he doesn't fit with the current campaign, you can make another character and then return to that first one later. With, like, the other thing to remember with that is when a character, as a GM, it's your job to keep the game flowing. It's your job to, you know, take the reins and make sure everyone's going along with the story. And player conflict is rough. And between a GM or a DM and players, or between players and players, it's always rough. So it's the kind of thing that it sucks to have to be the one to step in, but as a GM or a DM, that's your role. You have to be like, well, listen, out of character, you gotta figure this out. You either gotta make a new person who will go along with this story, or your person has to change how they feel about this. And, you know, railroading a person into changing their character is not something that's too fun or too great to do, but it is important for the sake of the other players, because you are playing with a group of people. It's a, you know, collaborative, friendly experience, so everyone's kind of working together with that. Also, in regards to, you know, players and how they interact with each other, we have our second question, and that's from Charlie. And Charlie's question is, do we have any experience handling unwanted PvP? He says that one time at a session, the characters were arguing. He was a necromancer, the other characters were all, like, more on the lawful good side, and the other PCs behind his back were planning on killing him. Now, that's super fucked up. I don't care how deep into role-playing you are, or how morally different your characters are, but alignment does not define your character. I often give a lot of people advice when they're starting to play and when they're building their characters to not write down an alliance. Or an alignment. You know, you start playing your character, and then based on your actions you take, that's how you figure out your alignment. Your alignment's a descriptor, it's not a definition. So when you have, you know, this group of people that have all made these lawful or neutral good characters, and then you have one person that says, you know, I want to play a chaotic evil character, and that party doesn't have to be a train wreck. It doesn't have to be hostile to one another, because as long as, you know, the DM or the GM makes a story that aligns to all of their opinions and all of their, they all have a common interest, or they're thrown together by fate or something like that, they don't have to be in conflict. And, you know, that doesn't mean the evil player that's the odd man out won't eventually leave, or that he won't be at odds with the rest of the party in his decisions. But it is the kind of thing that you have to think about. One thing that you definitely should not do is what Charlie's party here did, and try to, like, stealth assassinate another member of the party. Because in-game, that might be the kind of thing that would make sense. Although if you're playing a lawful good paladin, or, you know, lawful good characters, even if you're dealt with an evil character, that's that sneaky stabbing in the back thing is not something you would do. That's a whole nother thing. But out of character, you have to acknowledge that, like, you're a group of friends hanging out together trying to play a game. And if three people are going to team up on one person, that's some middle school playground bullshit. That's not fun. And those people might not even really be your friends. I know that's a little harsh, it's a little intense, but, like, it really frustrates me to see that, you know, there are people out there playing this game and they're doing these things, and this is what turns people off of D&D and other role-playing games. This is what makes people, like, never want to play a game. I know that I have talked to people throughout the years who have a hostility towards Dungeons & Dragons because the first time they played, they had, you know, a bunch of alphas who just railroaded them into playing a role that they didn't like, or they railroaded them into doing these actions that that's not what they wanted to do. So they lost all the freedom, and the freedom is the point of D&D. So regardless of where your character lies, everyone else in the party also has, you know, player rights. Everyone else in the party also has the right to play the character they want to. So you should never have a campaign where some of your PCs are outright fighting other PCs. For a couple reasons. Now, I myself and a lot of people I know use the, like, mirror puzzle or the changeling puzzle type thing, or, you know, the mind flayer brain control kind of stuff where you get your PCs to fight each other. And that's a challenge, that's a conflict, and that's the kind of thing that's an outside force forcing them to do that. And that's okay, because that's a unique challenge, that's a different kind of challenge, and it spins their players' worlds around. That's cool, and that's interesting to use. But at the end of the day in Dungeons & Dragons, player characters are not leveled to fight each other. So a level 4 rogue does not necessarily equal a level 4 fighter, or a level 4 paladin, or a level 4 wizard in combat. So PvP does not work well in Dungeons & Dragons, because the game's not balanced for that. Because you're not supposed to do that. It can be used as a unique encounter, but it shouldn't be something that, you know, you rely on as a force in your campaign. So PvP, it's not what the game is built for. There are other role-playing games and other role-playing systems where PvP is very possible, very easy, and very open to do. That's just not a D&D thing, because you're supposed to be a team. You're supposed to be working together, and as soon as you get, you know, the party conspiring behind each other's backs, shit starts to get bad. And I'll give an example. In Ben's campaign that he's running and I'm playing with, we've talked many times about the situation with the Sea Hag, where my character and another character got at odds with one another about the treatment of the Sea Hag, and so I broke off. And me and one other of the PCs went off alone. And if we weren't as lucky as we were, we would have just died. But also at the same time, our characters realized that, like, although we disagree, we're in this together. So I didn't, you know, be like, oh, well, this character that I disagree with is being bad, so I'm gonna kill them. It was just like, well, this guy who's my, you know, compatriot and my adventuring friend, and I disagree right now, and I'm not cool with the way he's treating this Sea Hag, so I'm gonna leave, because I don't want to be a part of this. And that's kind of the thing that that's the player responsibility, is being the bigger person. Like, a lawful good paladin, there's lots of jokes, and everyone hates paladins. It's one of those things where it's like, oh, the lawful good paladin is such a fun sucker. It's the party pooper of the party. But, like, at the same time, they are, more often than not, the actual voice of reason, the actual voice of good, where everyone's like, oh, we should torture this bandit we captured for information, and we should, you know, really get him good, and then murder him, and stuff like that. And the paladin's like, no, that's mean, we can't do that, that's evil. And it kind of reminds players that they are supposed to be a force for good. Unless, of course, you're playing, you know, an evil campaign, which is a whole nother thing. But, sorry, I got a little bit away from the point here, but in regards to PvP, the bottom line is it sucks. It's shitty to do, it's not cool, it's not okay. Next question we have today is from Max. And Max's question is in regards to how to deal with large parties. Now, as many of you may know, Dungeons & Dragons 5th Edition, which is what we talk about mostly and what we play, we will reference 4th and 3rd.5 because of the other two editions we're familiar with. But, like, I'm not a fan of 3.5. As soon as 5 came out, I was so happy, because 3.5 got really, really, really bogged down at the end. And that's something a lot of people disagree with me about, but, like, I think 3.5 sucks, because the idea that things like the pun-pun and, you know, mid-maxing to the point where you just make these broken-ass characters, it's a number crunch. It's a calculator roleplay where you just, alright, how can I multi-class and feat in a way to make this broken, undefeatable character? And that's not fun. The point of the game is role-playing, and that's why I love 5e, is because they focused back on that. And it's not about mid-maxing your character and making this, like, you know, giant killing machine. It's about playing the role, which is what's important. So, in regards to 5e, the party size is balanced for 4 PCs. That is the, you know, idea. If you're playing with 3, if you're playing with 5, you know, 1 in either direction doesn't affect the game that much. When you're playing with 3, sometimes combat gets a little harder. If you're playing with 5, sometimes combat gets a little longer, and you can kind of, as you play, adjust the game for that. But when you get into real troubles is when your parties get beyond 3, or beyond 5 characters, or under 3 characters. Now, if you have 2 people, 2 PCs in your party, or even you're playing a one-on-one, a one PC, the important thing to remember with that is most of the game functions exactly the same. The only problem is combat, where you have to realize that a challenge rating is balanced for a party of 4. So if you have 2 PCs and they're level 2, they can't take on a challenge rating 2. Because a challenge rating 2 is balanced for 4 level 2s. So with that, it's pretty simple math. You just go ahead and knock the challenge rating down to be more aligned. And it doesn't work exactly like that. Challenge rating system is a little wonky. It doesn't actually function well. It's the kind of thing where the more I play and the more experienced I get and the more comfortable I get with the monster manual and the rules and stuff is I start making my own creatures for the parties to fight from scratch, because then you can tailor them to your party's abilities. But if you are using the challenge rating system and you are using the monster manual, it's important to realize that it's 4-1. So 1 challenge rating 2 equals 4 level 2 PCs. And use that as your baseline and your math, and you kind of move on from there. Now, as soon as you get to more players than 5, that is what becomes, the game becomes a challenge for the GM. Now, Ben's campaign currently has 6-7 players. I know a lot of campaigns do get up there, and I know we mentioned it, and I'm going to talk about it a little more in a moment. I've ran a game for 10 PCs before. So, the first thing to realize when you have more than 5 players, or more than 4 players, is that now you have so many differing voices that everything your party tries to do is going to take twice as long. When you have 7 people and you have a problem in front of them, at least 3-4 different ideas are going to come up and be argued vehemently. There are going to be people who want to do plan A, plan B, plan C, and then you have the wildcard people who might just say, you know, fuck all this discussion, I'm going to go ahead and just act. And that's kind of, when you have the big parties, sometimes that's better. Because then everyone's like, all right, well, this person did this thing and now we have to deal with it. It becomes reactionary, and that way there's not that bogged down discussion. Sometimes that big discussion is good, though, because it develops players, and it kind of develops relationships where, you know, players learn about each other. Oh, this is how you would address this situation. I don't know if I really feel okay about that. So it's the kind of thing where you have to acknowledge as a DM or a GM that things will slow down. And that's okay. And sometimes it doesn't happen. Sometimes you have a party that's, like, all on the same page, and they're just like, all right, fuck it, this is our plan, let's do it. And that's great. The other thing to realize about big parties is combat. So one of the other reasons I did not like 3.5, and one of the reasons that a lot of friends of mine got turned off to D&D and haven't played since 3.5 is because of how long combat takes. Now, 5e did a great job of speeding combat up, and at the end of the day, a lot of that falls, in regards to the speed of combat, falls on the DM. And It also falls on the players, where, like, it's easy to fall into the pattern of just saying, all right, I attack. I'm not close enough? Okay, I move, and then I attack. And that's boring. And one of the things that it's important to do as a GM is to encourage your players to roleplay even in combat. So, although your rogue can just say, yeah, I sneak up behind him and stab him, that's kind of boring. But if your rogue starts to add flavor, add color to their actions, and say, alright, so I run and slide across the tavern table and dive roll behind the, you know, brigand and quickly push a dagger into his back. All of a sudden, that's a lot more interesting of an interaction. At the end of the day, it's still a move, maybe an acrobatics, and an attack, but it's a lot more fun to say that. A good way for GMs and DMs starting out to encourage this in players is two things. First, describe their actions for them. Because a lot of players don't know or aren't comfortable with doing that, so when the player's like, I attack, and they roll their d20 and they do hit, you can say something besides you hit. You can say, like, so the soldier you're fighting raises his shield, but you dash to the side and slip your blade up under it. That makes it a lot more exciting for the player, because now they didn't just do an attack, they did something interesting and fun. And so the GM can, you know, take the reins with the character's actions in regards to describing how specifically things happen. The other thing is death blows. Now, every PC, regardless of how they feel on combat, it feels cool to kill an enemy. It always does. That's, like, one of the coolest things about D&D is, like, when the GM turns to you after you said how much damage you deal, and they're like, alright, you killed him. And then the GM then says, how do you kill them? That is a great way to encourage your players to roleplay during combat. Because now, they get to deal this death blow, they feel cool, they feel accomplished, they have taken out the enemy, and they will go crazy. Like, the most, you know, reserved, calm, passive people in the real world, when they're dealing a death blow in Dungeons & Dragons, will become the most visceral, cruel monsters, and it is in the best way possible. So that is something that's important. With large parties, when you have that combat, because of how much it slows down, encouraging role-playing during combat is crucial. Because what happens when you have that long combat and it starts to slow down is people end up waiting for their turns and they get bored. And they don't listen to what's going on in combat. They sit there, they pull out their phones, and they check Twitter, they check Instagram, they read comics, they do whatever. They listen to, you know, music. They pull themselves out of the game. And that's because, you know, especially with 3-5, but even with 5e, with long parties, with large parties, you get to the point where you're waiting 15 minutes to get to your next turn, because you have all the other PCs and all the enemies, and you have to put in more enemies to deal with that larger party, so it just slows it down and bogs it down more. Now, with that, if you're role-playing, all of a sudden, you can get the rest of your party that's not acting stoked on what's going on, because if it's exciting and if it's action-y, they're invested, and they want to be like, oh, this guy's doing cool stuff, I want to do cool stuff too, which is super important. The other thing is to get your players excited about one another. So if you have your players supporting one another in combat, all of a sudden everyone's involved. If you encourage them to think tactically, even with or without the grid paper and the miniatures and all that stuff, even if you're doing theater of the mind, if you encourage them to work together, like, one of the funniest examples that you hear in a lot of podcasts is the terminology that's used a lot is the fastball special, where, you know, the giant character picks up the tiny character and hurls him at an enemy. And that kind of synergy action, that kind of, like, oh, I'm going to do this in collusion with my other party member, pulls everyone back in and keeps everyone together. And it also keeps combat going faster and fun because people are working together. Or, you know, if your fighter gets KO'd and they're down to 0 HP and they're knocked unconscious, and their cleric has to run over to heal them, if your ranger then says, like, all right, I'm going to lay down suppressive fire, that's something that's cool and interesting. If I was running that game, I wouldn't have the ranger make an attack necessarily. I would probably have them make some kind of homebrewed check where they're just going to start firing off arrows randomly at the enemy and then use that, if they succeed, as an armor class boost for the cleric while they run over to the fighter. So that's the kind of thing where you can, you know, make combat interesting and fun and make your players work together. And also along those lines, we come to our fourth question of the day from Ogis. And Ogis asks what rules you can break. And along with what I was just saying, that's something that's really important, where you have players that want to do an action, and the game does not necessarily plan for that, or necessarily have the rules for that. That is the prime time to dip into homebrew, dip into rule breaking. That is the time where you can go ahead and break the rules. Now, D&D, the coolest part about this game, the coolest part about D&D, is that it is, you know, creative. You can make your own world, you can make your own games, you can make your own everything. So with that, breaking the rules is something that is kind of important, but also needs to be balanced. The rules exist and are tested and are balanced for a specific reason. They work. Now, there are times where that doesn't align with what's going on in your campaign, and that's when a GM needs to break the rules. I think it was last episode, or maybe two episodes ago, we talked about GM magic. That's a term my friends and everyone we roll together use as, alright, this is the time where the GM's gonna lie, and he's going to lie to you because either through his actions or your actions, the party's been painted into a corner. And if they do not succeed on this one saving throw or this one ability check, the campaign is done. And when you're up against a brick wall like that, breaking the rules is what, it's what the game allows for, and it's what's built into the game. It's the kind of thing where, you know, you have a crucial piece of information, and one NPC has it. And if they don't succeed this intimidation or persuasion check, the players are not going to get that information, and then they're just bogged down. They can't proceed on their quest without this information. So that's when you give them an out. You always have to break the rules at that point. You always have to give your players a way to succeed. And this is the kind of thing that 5e allows for a lot, with a lot of the abilities and a lot of the rules of the game being pulled into the role-playing aspect. Role-playing is your way out always. So a lot of the times, in regards to the rules of the game, you don't necessarily have to break them, you just have to role-play. And yeah, sure, they might have failed their intimidation check, so this person's not afraid of them. But, like, that doesn't mean that they don't, that NPC doesn't believe they're going to kill them. So, yeah, they might not be intimidated, and they might treat the party like they're, you know, goofballs or whatever, but they're still going to give them the information, even if it's sarcastic or, you know, vitriolic or whatever, because they don't want to die. There's a role play out for you right there. The other thing with rules you can break is if something happens that's going to screw your party over. If you don't want to make a character grinder and, you know, one of your PCs gets downed and put to zero health points and you don't have a healer in your party, that's a great time to break the rules too. You can, you know, let's say they have two death saves that they've failed already. You can make up a rule right there and just be like, oh, as the DM, I'm going to roll your final death save, and roll it behind a DM screen, and then lie to them and say they passed, to give the players, you know, an ability to not have to re-roll their character. Because, you know, characters dying sucks. People put a lot of time and effort into their characters, and although there needs to be consequences for actions, dying is not something that should happen a lot in the game. It should be something that you dip your toes into with the whole death save functionality and dropping to zero hit points, but it's not something that you should do often. Character grinders are a fucking 3.5 idea, and they're horrible, and I will always hate on any DM who builds character grinders. I mean, there are times where your party expressly wants that, and they'll pre-roll 5 characters because they know they're going into the Tomb of Horrors, and they're gonna, you know, grind up their characters, and that's a whole nother thing that's really not fun. in my opinion, I guess I'll caveat it there. I just think it's really shitty when you have a character grinder. But those are the kind of rules you can break. Rules that are going to allow your party to not have fun, are going to pump the brakes on your game, are going to ruin your ideas. That's when you break the rules. Now, with that, also, you don't need to always break the rules. You can ignore some of them. Like, Ben and I talked about how we don't keep track of rations and survival checks and foraging and stuff like that, unless that's the focus of the campaign. And that's the kind of thing. Also, like, material components are something I think are really dumb and don't use them. So instead of thinking about it as which rules you can break, it's easier to think about, like, which rules can you ignore? And a lot of times, it's hard to tell. Now, with that, the easiest way is trial and error to find out. Because I could pull open my player's handbook right now and start listing off, like, oh, you can use that, you don't need to use that. But, like, honestly, my opinion doesn't really matter to your campaign. So, you have to, you know, think about it yourself and try it out. Like, if you say that, like, oh, this is a rule that I'm not a big fan of, so I'm gonna kind of eliminate it and see what happens. And if you eliminate it and everything still works fine, congratulations, you found a rule that you can ignore. But if you eliminate it and things start acting weird, the game starts breaking down, players are either too powerful or not powerful enough, then you know, like, alright, this is something that's crucial to the foundation of the game that I need to keep in. Or at least, if not keep in, create a comparable homebrew rule to kind of make up for that. So, with that, I hope I answered at least your questions to a degree. I know that we did respond to a couple of your Gmails with, you know, more in-depth. And if Ben were here, I know that he would have a lot to say. And, you know, maybe he will do a supplement episode like this one solo to kind of fill in his gaps where he feels they should be. But I feel like I've, you know, talked enough and rambled enough and kind of let you know how I feel about these questions. Also, I let my hatred for 3-5 bleed out a little bit today, and I've been trying to hold it back to not alienate a lot of potential listeners or what have you, but, like, I feel like this is a great time to get it out. I hate 3.5. At this point in my life, I think 4.0 is more useful as a game than 3.5 was, because although 4.0 had a lot of problems and was really, really lame, it watered down the game so it's easy for new players. And I think as a teaching tool, 4.0 is great. I think if you're playing Dungeons & Dragons, you should play 5e. 3.5 is horrible. Now, I will say, I don't have a lot of experience with it, but from what I understand, Pathfinder is a great alternative if you don't like 5e, if you miss the days of 3.5 and having 35 different skills and numbers that get into the 25s and just, like, ridiculous complicated math. Play Pathfinder. I heard it's fun, I've heard good things about it, I heard it's, you know, better than 3.5, so Pathfinder, if you don't like 5e. But 3.5 sucks. So, if you folks have any more questions, you can email us at dungeoncasterspodcast@gmail.com. Now keep in mind, Dungeon Casters Podcast has an S after casters. I think we, said that wrong a couple times in a couple episodes, so you do want to have an S after casters in our Gmail account. Or you can tweet at us at dungeon_casters. Maybe we'll answer your questions on a different episode. Maybe we'll do another one of these. This was pretty fun. I got to talk for, you know, 40 minutes straight, and you guys all had to deal with listening to me, so that was pretty fun for me. So Ben's not here. I'm not really going to be able to do my outro joke to him, but I'll do it to you guys. Have y'all ever heard the one about the angry mob? Oh, well, it's a riot!
In this podcast, we used Achilles and News Sting by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com, licensed under Creative Commons.